Okay, let's begin.
Okay, so I guess now you've been studying a little bit about sociology for 2 or 3 weeks. And I think one thing that is worth thinking about is where did this field come from and why do we have it in the first place? Let me ask a question. How many of you think that you live in the same society as everybody else in this class? How many of you think you live in the same society as everyone else in this class? Put up your hands. This is not a trick question. There's no right or wrong answer. I just want to see the hands. Put the hands a little higher so I can see them. Just for the record, I would say maybe 40%? 40% perhaps. Okay, you can put the hands down. Now you see, when I was a student in sociology originally 35 years ago, everybody would have put their hands up. Okay, and that's an interesting point in itself. I mean, exactly what is the nature of society? Because originally, if you go back and you look at, for example, how sociology textbooks tend to be organized, and you look at the way in which the sort of classical theorists in sociology talk about society, it's quite clear that the kind of thing that they have in mind is the nation state, right? So that the society you live in is the nation state. So insofar as all of you live in Britain, you live in the same society. Okay, and you know, I'm from the United States, and you know, everybody in the room, and you know, they asked that question 35 years ago, everybody would have put their hands up because they all live in the same country. Okay, and indeed, until quite recently, sociology textbooks used to be organized in a way that sort of presupposed you live all in the same country, and then you're going to look at different aspects of how social life operates. So you'd look at the economy, you look at the political structure, you look at education, you look at the family, right? You look at the police system, you look at a lot of other different systems that are going on, and they would be all systems of the same society. And in a way, sociology was founded very much with that kind of idea. Now, one of the things that you're going to be studying in the rest of this term, I was noticing from looking at your course outline, is the development of the state in the 19th and 20th centuries. And that's not by accident that you're studying that, because that is, in a sense, what a society was understood to be. And so then the question becomes, how does such an entity come into being, and in particular, how it is maintained, especially given all the sorts of challenges that something like a society can undergo. So, for example, a lot of the early textbooks in sociology and a lot of the ways in which we talk about sociology, even to this day, talks about social problems. Social problems. There are social problems. Now, the idea that there are social problems presupposes that there is some idea of society and that the society can either work well or poorly. Right, so there's some sort of notion of what we would call normativity, right? And this is a very important kind of notion within the history of sociology. Namely, how are things supposed to work if a society is working well? And so you can imagine a lot of things that would fall into this category. So for example, people are law-abiding citizens, right? People are healthy, right? People are working with each other, especially in terms of enabling each other, people to be able to live fulfilling lives, things of that kind. Okay, so you have this sense of normativity, which is a very important feature of what society is and describes a society that's working well. And then you could talk about, you know, various institutions and various individuals as functioning well in the society. And then correspondingly, you can talk about problems. What happens when things don't work? You have crime, for example. You have lots of illness. You have the society being attacked in various ways, perhaps militarily, politically, or even economically, through trade wars, for example. Now you see, that whole way of looking at the way in which human existence operates, that there's this idea of society, that we have a sense of what it means for it to work well, what it means for it to work poorly, that is all integral to what sociology is about. Okay, historically, that's where sociology is coming from, and it arises at a period in the 19th and 20th centuries when the nation-states are becoming very prominent. And what I mean by the nation-state in this context is, first of all, that the rule in society is a kind of secular rule. That's the first point. So we're talking about self-governing secular states. which is quite different from, you know, if you think about the way in which rule is organized throughout the world historically, and this was something the early sociologists spent a lot of time thinking about, very often there was, well, first of all, of course, there was always a sense of a sort of aristocracy ruling, but the aristocracy, in a sense, derived its legitimacy, that is to say, the authority that it had to rule, from sort of some sort of connection with religious authority, where the religious authority basically stood for a kind of general view of the world, right? And we can think about this in terms of something like the Holy Roman Empire, right? Which it in fact existed not only through the Middle Ages in Europe, but well into the 19th century, and it was out of the Holy Roman Empire that a lot of the modern nation states of Europe got carved out. Okay, so a nation state, in a sense, breaks away from religious authority, from hereditary authority of that kind, and is in some sense self-governing, where the people who constitute the country are in fact the people governing it. So there is a kind of connection between the rise of the nation state and democracy. And sociology, its history reflects this development very well. Because one of the things about sociology, in terms of the way we operate methodologically, is we're actually interested in what everybody thinks and does. Okay? Now that's kind of interesting. Because if you look at something like the humanities, for example, right, and you know about the humanistic subjects, philosophy and history and the classics, those sorts of disciplines, at least until the rise of the social sciences, those disciplines were typically only concerned with elite members of society. And in particular, as you know, the humanities tend to be very much biased toward the written word, right? So those who can write authoritatively. So politicians who are writing speeches and treaties, right? Philosophers who are writing great books, the great works of literature, right? Those are the things that are privileged as the achievements of the human condition. Now, you see, that's a very elite way of operating, and in a way it sort of acts on the assumption that that elite, in a way, can speak for all of humanity. Now, you see, one of the innovations of the social sciences, and in particular sociology, is to sort of democratize one's understanding of humanity so that all people count. Now, how do we see this at a methodological level? Well, you'll be studying this later in the course, and you can think about this both at the qualitative and the quantitative levels. Now, the qualitative levels have to do with this thing. You may have, you know, I think you were reading a little bit of Goffman earlier in the course, right? We have this thing called ethnography, where you actually study people in the areas where they live and work. And the kinds of people you're studying are ordinary people. You're not just studying elites. You're studying regular people, and what they do matters. And not only what they do that matters, but what they think about what they're doing matters. Right? The kind of interpretations that people give of what they're doing matters. Now, you see, this may sound very obvious to you, and you know, why do we need to go to university to study this? But this was, in fact, a kind of idea that only began to be taken seriously, both at the political level, and as we call it, in philosophy we have this term epistemology. Epistemology is the theory of knowledge. And so in other words, how do you find out anything about human beings? At the epistemological level, we need to ask them, because people know stuff about their lives that you just cannot figure out just by talking to elite members of society or reading Plato, you know, or any of the great philosophers, but you actually have to see how real people operate. This was something that actually took a while for people to figure out, to take seriously. And of course is now very much part of the bread and butter of how sociology operates in much of its research. But also this kind of democratizing in our understanding of humanity also applies to the quantitative level in which sociological research is conducted. And what I mean by quantitative level here is the issue of counting. Counting. Now you might think counting, well, what's so big about counting? Well, if you think about something, for example, like the sort of vital statistics that get taken about how many people belong to the different classes of society and so forth, where each person counts as one, that is a very democratizing move. Because if you see, if you look at the way in which societies were structured prior to the 19th century, it was very common to think about society not structured according to how many people there are in different classes, but just by the number of different classes. So it was very common, for example, in the way in which the French, original French Parliament was organized before the French Revolution, that the estate, what was called the estate, the class that consisted of the vast majority of the population, 90% plus of the population, was given as much weighting as the aristocracy and the clergy, who together maybe made up 5 to 10% of the entire population. Okay? But one of the things that happens in the development of the nation state and in the development of sociology is that each person's position and viewpoint gets taken seriously equally. And so counting reflects that, where each person counts as one. So you think about things like voting, for example. You think about, you know, buying things. The whole economic system, you know, is based on more people buying stuff, right? And that means that quantity counts. That is a democratizing move in itself. So we don't ask questions about your birth or anything like that. We just care what you do in particular situations. Now, so both the quantitative and the qualitative sides of sociology both have to do with this idea that all human beings matter. We need to study them all together, how they interact with each other, in order to come up with this kind of large-scale notion of a society where everybody is valuable. Okay. Now, I think the thing that should be pretty clear from my way of discussing this is that a society is not just something that happens by itself. That a society, in a sense, has to be actively constructed. And so we think about things, for example, like national constitutions, right, where you get a sense in which a country lays down what its principles are, what it is to be a citizen, you know, what are the rights and obligations that people have if they're going to be members of this society, okay? So there's a sense in which that creates a kind of political boundary for the society about who's in and who's out. And the interesting thing, of course, is that to be a member of one of these nation states, you don't necessarily have to be born in it. So in other words, membership isn't exclusively on hereditary grounds. There's a sense in which you can become a member of this society by doing certain kinds of things on your own, right? And that's kind of an important point, right? Because what that means is that your social identity is something that you actively participate in. It is not just something given to you, right? It is something that you achieve in conjunction with others. So there is this very active construction of your identity that goes on. And again, this is one of the legacies of the nation state. Now, you know, at a more fundamental level than that, there is this phenomenon which some of you, if you've studied some political philosophy, let's say, may know about, which is very much behind the idea of national constitutions, and often in the history of sociology kind of gets used to be described as the primitive social arrangement, and that is the so-called social contract. Okay? How many of you have heard of the idea of the social contract? Okay, so a few of you have. That's good. The social contract is a kind of concept that became very popular, you might say, among philosophers writing in the 17th and 18th centuries. And it basically is used as kind of an explanation for how people come out of what's known as the state of nature. That is to say, when, you know, they're acting like animals, where animals can be understood in a lot of different ways, by the way. So animals may be understood as very peaceful creatures, or animals could be understood as very wild and kind of malicious creatures. You have a little different sorts of views of animals here. But the point is there's some kind of moment where people come out of that state of being an animal and join together to work in common projects that have long duration, right, which is the basis of social life, and that is the social contract. So people agree, for example, not to fight each other unnecessarily, or they agree to, as it were, trust someone else to resolve their disputes, like a court or a king or someone like that, right? And so this is what the social contract is about. Now, the interesting thing about the social contract is it pretty much gets used to define the basis for all kinds of social relations that people engage in. So not just political relations, but also economic relations. And you see, the formation of the economy is a very important part of what sociology is about, and especially the rise of capitalism. Okay? And this is something else you'll be studying about later on in this module, because the rise of the nation state and the rise of capitalism go very much together. And what happens in capitalism? Well, you have to, again, think about what an economy is prior to capitalism's rise. And capitalism really kind of becomes a kind of widespread phenomena really in the 18th century, late 18th century, with the Industrial Revolution. What you end up getting is this idea that basically people, the value that items have, such as the land and so forth, is not determined by some kind of hereditary process. So who owns the land depends on, you know, whose father owned the land. What can you do with the land depends on what some king allows you to do, right? That's a very sort of traditional way of thinking about economic value, that it has this kind of historical, traditional tie to it. But what capitalism does is it basically says the value of material goods, the value of resources, is determined purely by exchange. In other words, what people are willing to pay for it. Right? So in other words, it's open for negotiation. It is open for exchange. It is open for trade. And again, you get this kind of new world opening up where people are able and allowed to sort of transform the identity of the spaces in which they live, even their own identities. So for example, you may come from a peasant background where all your ancestors are tied to the land, but in this kind of modern world that we enter in the 18th century, this capitalist world, you are able to, as it were, exchange that relation. You no longer have to stay on the land. You can get another kind of job. You can get an education, perhaps. You can become a different kind of person. And this whole idea of being able to construct your own identity so that you are not tied to your past through various sorts of exchanges that you engage with other people in society. This is very much a part of the way in which capitalism works in tandem with this nation state that is coming into being in the 19th century. Okay? And sociology is arising in this context. Now you see, one of the things that immediately becomes apparent when you start to think about this sort of development is what is gained and what is lost, right? Because the word that gets used a lot in sociology to talk about this sort of transition I'm talking about, where we're moving from the nation state, we're moving to the nation state rather, we're moving to capitalism, we're moving away from religion, we're moving away from sort of mystified notions of the land and heredity and so forth. The term we use is modernity. And modernity is seen, for the most part by sociologists, as a positive thing, but there are costs, okay? I mean, the positive aspects of modernity in a way are already implicit in some of the things I've been saying. One of them being, of course, freedom, right? Your freedom in a way you didn't have before because your identity is not tied to your past. In a sense, you can make yourself up as you go along. At least that's the theory, okay? You may not succeed, but the point is that's open to you to do. So there's a kind of freedom that goes with modernity. And that freedom happens at many different levels, right? It's not just the freedom to be able to shift jobs and to move from one part of a country to another, but it's also freedom of expression as well. It becomes easier to actually learn about more things, to participate in public life, right? You start to get the extension of the vote to more and more people in society through the 19th century. So you have a wide range of freedoms opening up. And that freedom, in a way, goes together with a kind of democratic sensibility, where what I mean by that is that people, in a way, treat each other more equally. Not completely equally, by no means. There are still all the class differences, all the class prejudices, all those kinds of things. But one of the interesting things about modernity is that those traditional class differences start to be seen as prejudices. In other words, the sorts of markers that in the past would have been used as indicators of living in a stable society, like there's a clear upper class, there's a clear lower class, the upper class has a kind of paternalistic concern for the lower class, the lower class is obedient to the upper class, those kinds of relationships, which still persist into the 19th and 20th centuries, start to be seen negatively. They start to be seen negatively. They start to be seen as relics of a past we've got to get rid of. So there's a sense in which what modernity does is modernity creates a certain kind of historical sensibility, a certain idea of progress, right? And progress implies direction, that history is going somewhere, and as it were, you can tell what the back is, what you're leaving, and where you're going. That kind of mentality, which I think we do have still to a certain extent, you know, that there are certain things that we regard as old-fashioned. And old-fashioned is seen as a negative thing. It is something we should leave behind. This is very much the calling card of modernity, to think in those terms, okay? And again, you know, these are ideas that we're that are very much part of the way we live. And I think here, you know, keep in mind one very strong motivator in promoting the modern mentality is capitalism, because capitalism, one thing as you are probably very well aware of, is capitalism is always in the business of creating new markets, new products, new tastes, new fashions. So capitalism, in a way, is a kind of economic means of manufacturing this modern mentality of thinking that, you know, anything that's been around for a while is old-fashioned and we got to go beyond it. Right? So capitalism kind of turns that mentality of modernity into a commodity, you might say. Right? Into something you can buy or sell. And that's you might say, the positive side of modernity is it has this kind of progressive, freeing, democratizing kind of sensibility going along with it. So what's the negative side of modernity? Well, the negative side is that people lose touch with their past. They lose touch of where they came from. Right? And so you have a whole lot of stuff in classical sociology that is concerned precisely with this issue. And so, you know, you can talk about, you know, there are all sorts of words that people use, right? I mean, so for example, Marx talks about alienation. Okay? Emile Durkheim, who is the founder of sociology in France, right, talked about anomie. And, you know, Max Weber, the great German sociologist, talks about the disenchantment of the world. All of these things have to do with modernity, okay? And these are seen as negative things. You know, so for example, alienation, what is that about? Alienation is about the fact that when you work in the capitalist system, you don't really have any control over what happens to your labor, right? In that sense, you're alienated from it. Alienation is a legal term, which literally means that you take something that is your own possession and you basically turn it over to someone and you sell it. So for example, if you sell your labor, right, then, you know, so I go and apply for a job, I get the job, the guy who employs me then tells me what to do, and I, in a sense, have to act as if I were his instrument. That's an example of the alienation of your own labor. You don't determine what you do when you work for somebody else. The other person does. Of course, this is all done within legal constraints, so your employer can't force you to do just any old thing. But nevertheless, there is an aspect in which the employer can force you to do things that you don't want to do, but you need to do in order to earn a living. Okay? Moreover, what you're doing, you don't have any control over how it's used. So let's say you work in a factory, you produce a certain kind of good on an assembly line. You don't know what's going to happen to that product once it leaves the factory. You have no control over it. Again, you're alienated from the labor. And you see, this is all portrayed positively as part of a rational division of labor, right? Where capitalism is this complex system where different people do different things. And so there's no expectation that any given individual will have full control over the whole system. Everybody's just a part of the system. But that implies that everybody's alienated from the system. This is a kind of Marxist point, okay? Now Durkheim talks about this issue of anomie. Anomie literally means without law, without norm, right? And he's talking about a certain kind of rootlessness that takes place in modern society when on the one hand, people no longer believe in, let's say, traditional religion. So they don't believe in the kinds of things that grounded people in the past. So they've lost their faith. They're not really tied to their family very much. Right? They live far away from where their mothers and fathers live. right? And they're rootless. And this is very much, you know, this was already seen by the time Durkheim is writing in the end of the 19th century, this is already becoming quite a common way of being for those people who are living in cities, right? That the people who live in the cities often, you know, their parents lived in the country, their parents were religious people, but these people living in the city are kind of urban, cosmopolitan people, right, who have no connection to their past. They're thoroughly modern people. But the problem is, they're so modern, they're not connected to anything. And so Durkheim is very interested, I mean, the concept gets developed in the context of trying to make sense of suicide rates. Why do people commit suicide in modern society? Okay? Why do the suicide rates rise? And this is the rootlessness that we're talking about here. And this is part of the downside of modernity. People are no longer grounded in communities. They are no longer embedded in their pasts. They basically are just struggling as very solitary individuals. And they just can't make it. Okay? And this problem, of course, is still very much with us today as the alienation problem. Now, Weber talks about the disenchantment of the world. Okay, now this is a very interesting aspect. This is a very interesting part of what modernity does. Because, see, one of the things about the religious worldview, especially if you look at something like Christianity, which was kind of the dominant religious worldview well into the modern period. So, for example, most national educational systems in Europe do not become fully divested of religious teaching until the third or fourth quarter of the 19th century. Okay, so religion is still very integral, even into that modern period. Okay. Now, one of the things about the religious worldview was that it was incredibly integrated. That is to say, not only did it try to tell you, how the world worked and so forth, but it tried to give you an explanation for why it worked the way it did, right? What is the meaning of it all? What is the purpose of life? What are human beings here for? Why are human beings special? You know, these are the kind of issues that do continue to occur, especially when one thinks about debates concerning things like euthanasia and abortion, you know, all these issues that have to do with the life and death matters, right? They're still, these are the moments where, in a sense, this kind of, this old religious kind of mentality does still operate, right? Where, in a sense, whether or not it is appropriate to have euthanasia or to have abortion has a lot to do with what you think the meaning of a human life is. Now, this was something that was very much common and very pervasive through a kind of religious worldview, but drops out of the picture in the modern worldview. Because in the modern worldview, the idea is that every individual, as it were, decides for themselves what the meaning of their lives is. Right? In other words, you don't go to school, as it were, and learn a religious doctrine so you can find out what the meaning of life is. Rather, the meaning of life is something that each individual decides for themselves. And what you learn in school is a relatively value-neutral knowledge. Right? So in school and in university, we're not supposed to be indoctrinating you. We are supposed to be telling you the facts, telling you what the smartest people working in the field think about various subjects. Right? But we're not supposed to be giving you your values. Your values are something you come up with yourself. This is very much part of what Weber talks about as disenchantment. Right? The world itself does not have a meaning. You're the one who puts the meaning on it. And again, this is, this is a very daunting kind of picture. Weber said that it's not surprising that as a result of this kind of radical split of values from facts. You know, we talk about the difference between facts and values. Well, this is what we're talking about, right? Where the facts are the things you learn in education, they're the things you're being taught, but values are things you supply yourself and nobody can tell you how. Okay? Now, Weber argues that, in fact, this can very easily lead to a very kind of nihilistic viewpoint. That is to say, the idea that the world is just meaningless. Right? That it doesn't matter what you do. And again, we go back to this point about suicide and alienation and all this. And that modernity, in a way, is full of expressions of nihilistic sensibility, right? Of loss of values, right? Or lack of values, or cynicism about values, right? Where, in a sense, anything goes because nothing really matters, okay? And Weber is very concerned that, in a sense, this is a very high price that modernity pays for all of its more progressive aspects. And you see, sociology has always been grappling with that as well, right? The issue of where do people get meaning in their lives in the modern world, okay? And there are all kinds of answers that are given, of course, and the answers are given in varying spirits. So, for example, you know, people, you know, supposing you get an answer, and this is an answer some sociologists would take seriously, the meaning of life is shopping. The meaning of life is shopping. Now you might say, well, is that a silly idea? Well, you certainly spend, you know, it's a good way to spend time and money. It helps the economy, and it gets you through the day, and it also provides you with a way of differentiating yourself from other people, because you don't all buy the same things. In a capitalist society, there are lots of different goods to choose from, and you can, as it were, pick out the goods that specifically suit you as an individual. So you can display your individuality very well through shopping. Right? So it's not such a bad answer, is it? Meaning of life is shopping. And it's a collective ritual that everyone can participate in 24 hours a day. It's the ultimate religion. Okay, is this a silly idea, or is this the truth? I mean, in sociology, things are never so clear, right? But the point is, this is something in a way that is kind of on the table as an issue, right? That in a sense, modernity, in a way, strips away a lot of the traditional justifications for one's meaning in life. And so, in a sense, you've got to come up with something else, right? At least insofar as, you continue to live. Now, this issue of meaning of life does bear very much on the issue of what it is to be a society, okay? Because you see, if you go back to one of the things that modernity had going for it in its early period was this idea of the nation state. Because one of the things that the nation state did was it gave you an additional identity to your individual identity. So in other words, not only are you these free individuals who can, you know, get jobs wherever you feel like it, vote in elections and all that kind of stuff, but you're also members of the same society. You're all British, right? Regardless of your class background, you know, what region of the country you come from, whether you were born here or become naturalized, you're all British. And that gives you an additional level of identity, which does provide something like a sense of collective meaning. Okay? And of course, one of the ways in which this really got enacted very strongly in the modern era was through patriotism, nationalism, right? Which of course is very much demonstrated during wartime, where you get this very interesting phenomena of people from many different walks of life, many different classes of society, who would otherwise have nothing to do with each other, all of a sudden working together to defeat a common foe. Okay? From a sociological standpoint, that idea is quite interesting, right? Because in a way, it demonstrates that it is possible for people who otherwise live quite different lifestyles and otherwise have nothing to do with each other, nevertheless can work together for a common cause. And so patriotism, you know, was always kind of a very fascinating topic from that standpoint. But of course, patriotism isn't what it used to be. So let me ask the question here. How many of you would consider yourself patriotic? If someone could put up, please, I don't see any hands at this point. Someone put up their hands if they believe it. Okay, so what are we talking about here? Less than 10% for sure. Maybe 6 people. Okay. Now you see, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, because the question that arises then is, on what basis do you ground your sense of belonging with each other? Right? We go back to this business of what the boundary of the society is. What is the nature of the collective to which you all belong? Because so far, based on the two, you know, shows of hands that I've asked about, you know, the first question about how many of you think you belong to the same society, and now this question about how many of you are patriotic, one gets the sense that many of you, if not most of you, think of yourselves as just kind of in this room pretty arbitrarily, right? That in a sense, you're each in the room for your own reasons, but the fact that you're all together in this room is pretty arbitrary. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? So in a sense, right, this is not a society, what we've got in this room. We've just got an arbitrary collection of individuals. Okay? Now you see, this is from a sociological standpoint, you might say there's an interesting exercise to be had to, you know, maybe you want to discuss this in a seminar or something. How would you characterize the social formation of this lecture? Right? Is this some kind of social group or not? See, the early sociologists actually were very interested in this kind of question. How do you tell one society from another? How do you talk about levels of social organization? And so far, just based on the evidence I've been able to collect here, it looks like this is a very loose social organization, if organized at all. In fact, it looks to me like the only thing that's organizing this social arrangement are the chairs. Right? That this is actually creating the organization, and that there is, as it were, nothing conceptual behind the arrangement of the chairs. So as it were, the physical space is a lot smarter than the people sitting on them. It's a very interesting point, right? But sociology is very concerned with that kind of issue, because one of the things that sociology generally privileges is the idea of social organization. That in a sense, the human condition is better, or in some way improved, by better forms of social organization, however that is defined. Okay? So, for example, if you look at something like Marxism, right? Marxism is basically a strategy to get from capitalism to socialism, right? Where capitalism is given some credit for having made people more mobile and able to sort of possibly exploit their talents better because they're not tied to the lands where they were born, right? But at the same time, capitalism doesn't quite enable people to really fulfill themselves, and that in order to fulfill themselves, they have to move to this other thing called the socialist society, communism, okay, to do that. So there's a preoccupation in classical sociology with this idea of what is a good social organization. What sort of social organization actually enables people to be all they can be, to enable human flourishment, okay? And the idea is that there's supposed to be an answer to this question. And this kind of issue, of course, doesn't just arise at the general level of how whole society should be organized, but of course they have more practical applications. So for example, if you're a manager of a firm, right? If you're a manager of a firm, how do you organize your workers to get the most out of them? That is a kind of small, very specific version of the same problem, where there's some sense in which social organization is an important key to enabling things to happen. But the problem is, in the world in which we live now, social organizations are very loose. And people's affiliations and ties to various social groups are very loose. Okay? One of the reasons why this is the case, of course, is the fact that it is possible in our society to adopt many different identities which don't necessarily have to add up to anything. Right, and so you think about specifically the amount of time that people spend on the internet, where the internet, in a sense, becomes a kind of social shaping space, right, just based on the amount of time that people spend on it. And yet, in that arena, right, do you need to put forward a consistent social identity? Well, answer is no, right? You can adopt all kinds of identities, right, and you just can keep them fragmented. And as it were, each identity you adopt is just affiliated to a particular network for as long as you need it to be affiliated. So there's no sense in which, you know, you are affiliated to something for your entire life and becomes your entire identity. So if you think about it, when I was a kid, people often talked about, you know, that the job that you got was part of your identity for life. There was this idea that you basically got training to become something, to become some kind of profession, to occupy some kind of job, that in principle you would have for the rest of your life. And that, as it were, you would become that kind of person. Now the interesting thing, of course, is that over the last 30, 40 years, with the increasing what we call the casualization of labor, right, more and more short-term labor, people are in fact getting used to the idea that they're going to be holding maybe a whole succession of jobs over the course of their lives, each one of which will only be, you know, 5 or 10 years, and then they move on to the next one, Okay? And indeed, this has changed a lot of things in our society. So the idea of education, increasingly we're getting used to the idea of people going back for additional schooling. So there's no finishing point to education because people train to become something else. Now my point in bringing all that up is to show that the kind of bases for establishing a social identity, which traditionally was a way in which you sort of, as it were, made strong social bonds. So, you know, you would say, well, you know, I trained as a carpenter. I am a carpenter for my entire life. That is part of who I am. That kind of mentality is disappearing now. Similarly, in the past, people would be members of religions, often the religions of their parents. That, too, established a certain kind of identity. People used to be married for their lifetimes. That also established a certain kind of identity and certain kind of family ties. All of these things have gradually disappeared. So that the traditional ways in which we would have strong social bonds, even in modern society, have become fragmented. And so as a result, our relationship to social groups is becoming more tenuous. So the idea of thinking about, you know, what kind of a social arrangement this class is, what kind of social organization this class has, right, is not a trivial question. Right? Because in a sense, one's relationship to various aspects of society have become much, much looser. And this, you might say, is very much a problem right on the doorstep of sociology. Because if sociology cannot deal with that issue, then it has no point existing. Okay? Namely, what is the relationship of people to society? Now, this whole line of argument that I've been pursuing here about the tenuousness of people's connection to traditional social arrangements, this is often what is known as a sort of postmodern condition. Postmodern condition, what I've been talking about now. How many of you have heard of this term, postmodern? Ah, wow, that's impressive. We live in interesting times. It's almost a whole class, for the record, knows about postmodern. Okay, well, this is the postmodern condition, what I've been talking about. You know, by the way, again, when you people get older, you'll appreciate this. Back when I was a student, the word postmodern doesn't get really coined until 1979. There is no such term before then, okay? And it's interesting, now everybody knows it. Now everybody knows it. Well, this is the condition we're in now, and there are some people who argue that in a sense, sociology is no longer possible in the postmodern condition because there isn't a robust notion of society left. Okay? So for example, look what happened to Marxism. Marxism's dead, right? Socialism's dead. We all know that. The Labour Party told us, right? I mean, Tony Blair, first thing he did, right? I mean, so and if you look at all of these classic, you know, the bases on which the idea of society underlying sociology was grounded in the 19th century, all of these things have had the rug pulled out from under them. The nation state, for example, the various forms, what would be called socialization, processes of socialization. Think about something like education, for example. This would be the kind of thing that Durkheim, in particular, would point to as part of a primary process of socialization, the way in which people from many different backgrounds become member of one society. They learn a common language. They learn a common history. They learn what it means to be French, for example. Okay? Now you look at the state of education today. It is very hard to keep together a national curriculum. There are increasing demands about multiculturalism, for example, and the respect for different cultures within national boundaries. So this whole idea of education as a process of common socialization, that is being exploded too. Okay? And so there is an issue as to where is the boundary of society? Where is the boundary of society and what maintains that? And the answer may be there's none. There is none. That there is no such thing as society. Margaret Thatcher, some of you older might remember this. 1987, Margaret Thatcher gave an interview with a women's magazine where she basically said very straightforwardly, there is no such thing as society. You can still see t-shirts that have it on there. There's no such thing as society. All there is are communities and families. It's a bit big society-ish, actually, what she's saying. You know, those of you who follow trends in the Conservative Party. So the idea here is that there is no such thing as the kind of thing that really interested the early sociologists. That really doesn't exist. The nation state, all of those things really are just fictions. The only thing that exists are the actual bonds that individuals have to the people, you know, their loved ones and the people they work with in their own communities. There's nothing more to society than that. Now, Thatcher was making this point partly as an argument against the welfare state. And I will end on this point, because the welfare state is one of the things that you might say has been sort of the backbone of the strong notion of society that sociology was founded on. And so those of you who do take some social policy courses in our department, I mean, social policy is very much a discipline of the welfare state. And the point about the welfare state is that the way in which you, as it were, continually make people see that they're part of the same society is by, in a way, legislating the society in a way that people are forced to take each other seriously. And one of the ways of that happening, of course, is through the redistribution of income and wealth, the tax system. Because the whole point of having the rich people subsidize poor people is the presupposition that they're both members of the same society and that they are both interdependent. That is a fundamental assumption of the welfare state. When people want to say, I'm paying too many taxes, or I shouldn't be paying taxes at all, or the taxes aren't benefiting me specifically, they are pulling away from that assumption. Okay? And I think it's worth pointing out that before the 19th century, before the rise of the nation state, before people even started talking about welfare very seriously, rich people and poor people did not necessarily think they lived in the same society. Okay? They did not necessarily think that. People really... The nation state, in a sense, invented that kind of conception where one society contains many different kinds of people who are interdependent. And that, in a sense, we are all mutually responsible for each other, and that perhaps the tax system is the most explicit way in which that is expressed. And from that you get national education system that's concerned about everyone's education, national health service. All of that, that is part of the backbone of the welfare state, and the strong sense of society presupposed by sociology rides on that. Okay? Now, insofar as all those ideas and all of those institutions are beginning to fall apart, sociology's own future is in jeopardy. Okay? And so I do think we're living in very interesting times here, because, you know, as you go through this course, you know, if you still think that sociology is relevant for understanding the world in which we live, then you should take a look at how the world is changing, because it's making it more and more difficult for a lot of sociological concepts to really have purchase. Okay? I'll stop here. You'll have the rest of the module and the next term to kind of deal with these matters more. And I will be putting this lecture up on the website.